Top of the news this evening is speculation concerning the real facts behind the Department of Health announcement about a radioactive spill supposed to have occurred yesterday at the state nuclear plant.
I know what you're thinking. Mine's bigger than yours, right? Isn't that fair? Throw it away. All right?
Tons of popcorn there. Yeah. And all you gotta do is go climb a tree to go eat it.
It was a night like any other night. Then something happened.
Oh, good Lord. It's unbelievable. It's horrible.
Welcome to the Really Awful Movies Podcast, a celebration of low-budget cinema.
The sleep of reason gives birth to monsters.
Hi, my name's Chris, and along with Jeff, we're bringing you the very best and worst of horror, sci-fi, post-apocalyptic wasteland, kung fu, and women in prison movies from the 1960s to today. Check us out at reallyawfulmovies.com, part of the Crypt TV family.
We're at downtown Toronto headquarters. Here's episode 154, George Romero's The Crazies.
Yeah, and this is 1973, so this is not Romero's direct follow-up to his breakout movie, breakthrough movie, revolutionary movie, 1968's Night of the Living Dead, a movie that is in that rarefied handful of films that changed the direction of cinema forevermore. You follow that one up with a movie called There's Always Vanilla, which came out in 1971. I have not seen There's Always Vanilla. There is a movie that came out after that in 72 called Hungry Wives, a.k.a. Season of the Witch.
Now, Hungry Wives. Okay, sorry. No, I never heard of that, but Season of the Witch is like, that's a great title.
Well, but the reality is that the horror elements, I mean, there was witchcraft in Season of the Witch, and I did see it, but I don't remember much of it, but it really wasn't a very horrific movie. I think they changed the title from Hungry Wives to Season of the Witch to sort of capitalize on the horror audience that he gained from Night of the Living Dead. And looking at some posters for Season of the Witch, they said, you know, the master of horror returns. I mean, when he made Night of the Living Dead, that was it. He was a made man in horror. This movie in 73, so this is 5 years after Night of the Living Dead, I guess you could say this is his true horror follow-up to Night of the Living Dead. The only problem is that it's really not that... I mean, it is a horrific movie, and it touches on a lot of themes that are scary, and it's got the patented Romero social commentary. It's not that scary. There are things about it that are scary in theory, when you think about it. And there's a lot of questions Romero raises, but is this a successful horror movie, or is it a successful movie? That's what we're going to have to explore in this discussion. Now, this was my second viewing of the movie. When I first saw this film, I can't even recall how many years ago it was, but it was when I first got into horror, and I really wanted, you know, was going back and trying to watch all the films that of these auteurs that I get my hands on. Loving The Living Dead, loving Dawn of the Dead, loving Day of the Dead.
Loving Martin.
Oh, of course. Yeah. Well, and then I think I saw The Crazies after that, and I remember not being as impressed. There was something about it that felt lacking. Now, I was excited to revisit it for this podcast because you suggested, let's do The Crazies. I'm like, okay, well, you know, it's been a little while, but sometimes movies really do increase in your estimation as the years go on. I've said this before. Movies are static. Once they're out there, we're not. We change. And as we change, how we read movies change as well. A movie that we might have thought was absolutely brilliant might start to lose its luster. Other movies might start to gain in our appreciation. Other movies we just either think was crap at the beginning, it's crap now, or vice versa. It was brilliant then, it's brilliant now. So, with The Crazies, I went in with an open mind, looking to see if I could, you know, sort of put it within the rest of Romero's filmography and understand where it fits in, and also, and maybe appreciate it a bit more. And I'm going to say that watching it for a second time, there's things about it I really do admire and appreciate, but it just wasn't wholly successful. It just, it, again, it did not thrill me the way I wanted to thrill me on this second viewing. Yeah. All those many years from the first.
Yeah, likewise. It's a bit like trying to fashion something of out of leftovers that you have in the fridge. Like, he fully explored these themes much better in other films like Dawn of the Dead, Night of the Living Dead, where you have ordinary people facing unusual circumstances, having to band together and rally around one another to fight off an external force. And that is far better explored in other films, even in the biohazard space, which is one that I really love. Mm-hmm. I saw the remake of this with 2010's Timothy Oliphant star, The Crazies.
Which I saw as well.
And
neither
of us remember any of it, other than
one lick of that movie.
Yeah.
I mean, 1 second.
I just remember some bad cinematography and a real slickness that plagued, pardon the pun, a lot of the films that came out in the 2010s, 2011s. It had a slick appeal. It doesn't appeal to me, but it just was wholly lacking. And really, this should be an arena that should be just fraught with terror, because there's two competing interests. There's townsfolk who are trying to escape a plague, and there's...
But not necessarily a plague, because the townsfolk don't really know. Some do, some don't, right?
No, fair enough, yeah.
Because, I mean, what they're trying to escape is an oppressive force, this being a group of... a large group of soldiers that are going around home to home, establishment to establishment, rounding them up, trying to quarantine them within this high school, because the town of Evan City
yeah.
is afflicted with this plague. Some people sort of know, because they know by experiencing people acting strangely through dementia, because this plague, it'll either kill you or cause your brain to rot and you're going to experience dementia.
Yeah.
But they don't necessarily know. In fact, a ragtag group of survivors or resistors, the reason why they know is because the woman, the catalyst that brings them together, Judy, is a nurse who works for a doctor.
And she's received an inoculation.
Exactly. And this doctor, Dr. Meyer, I believe his name was, told her to go, because she's pregnant, take this inoculation, go give it to your husband, and see if you can escape before all hell breaks loose. He knows that the army's coming. He knows that the directors are coming from up high. He knows that shit's going to go down. He's like, go, get your husband, get out of here. And that duo ends up becoming a trio with the addition of, that's Judy and Dave, with the addition of Clank, who's like a friend. And they both were in the army, I believe. They both were in the Vietnam War.
Yeah.
One was a Green Beret.
And one was a volunteer firefighter as well. So. Yeah.
And then they pick up a couple along the way. Kathy, the sort of hippie chick played by Lynn Lowry, and her father. So there's that story. Are we invested in them, or are we invested in the townsfolk of Evans, who are being rounded up, quarantined? Are we invested in Dr. Watts, this wonderful
savior,
character
yeah.
played by the wonderful Richard France, who is, Romero watchers, they're going to smile when they see him, obviously, because he was in There's Always Been a Little Which I Haven't Seen, but he was also a very brief role in Dawn of the Dead, when at the beginning with the tenement, and when they're going to the tenement to blow away the zombies, and there's like a TV talking about the plague, and that's him. And he's got this wonderful Orson Welles-like...
Yeah, sonorous, booming voice.
Who are we invested in? But at the end of the day, so we have these two stories going on, right? We've got the townsfolk who are trying to protect themselves from this nefarious outside force, which is rounding them up, taking away their rights, etc., quarantining them for quote-unquote the greater good, but they don't know what the hell, why, why is this happening, and all they know what to do is to defend themselves against, you know, they're basically have to form a sort of militia.
Militia, like a Second Amendment militia type, and we're speaking very generally and euphemistically about a plague, because it really isn't a plague in the sense of your Camus or what have you. This is a experimental vaccine, in quotes, that was being transported by military aircraft that crashed in Pennsylvania nearby this town, but we find out that this was actually not an experimental vaccine, but biochemical warfare, and it got into the water system, and got into, it's waterborne, and so this is a mishap. This is a major calamity. This is a major mistake on behalf of the government, and now they have to pick up the pieces and deal with this before it spreads beyond what they call the perimeter. And this is what this is a constant refrain. They have to secure the perimeter, and the army's role is to cordon off this town, which is a very small town. That high school is probably the only high school in this town. Several thousand people. They have to quarantine everyone.
It's probably the only building that they actually that would be capable of.
Yeah, exactly.
All the innocents of the town. Yeah.
And this should be exciting stuff.
Mm-hmm.
Military called in. Quarantine. Hazmat suits. NBC suits. Nuclear biochemical suits. Mm-hmm. This, on the surface, is scary. Conceptually, execution-wise, not so much. It's a movie called The Crazies, and the symptoms that they manifest once they are exposed to this pathogen, little dementia-type symptoms, erratic behavior.
A little homicidal, too.
Yeah, but that's not really explored, because only a few characters really wig out. And
but the ones that wig out well.
And yeah.
It really comes with the movie.
And but that really should be the tension, because if we were in a survival situation like that, mm-hmm. I mean, the paranoia that would induce anyone who so much as, well, in subsequent zombie movies, they tend to cough or exhibit some other type of symptom. They either bleed from the nose or whatnot, but you would be at one another's throats, and the paranoia would be to the extreme as you're trying to suss out who is next to who, because at that point, it's every man for himself.
Well, what's interesting about this movie is there really are no obvious symptoms. I mean, there's this wonderful scene where they come upon this old lady in a rocking chair, and this is when they're trying to round up people and get them in, you know, into the high school, and she just looks docile and innocuous. She's knitting with a pair of knitting needles, and then she just gets up, as matter of fact as can be, stabs a soldier with the knitting needles, sits back down, and continues her knitting. So there really is no symptom. And
again, is that a fatal wound? A happy birthday to me, a knitting needle to
let's not get to that right now.
Anyway, yeah, exactly, yeah.
No, you love
contagion movies. Yeah, for sure.
And I mean, here in Toronto, we actually lived through a little bit of this, I can't remember the year now, the summer of SARS.
Yeah, where I guess the ground zero for this was, I think, China. Mainland China, and it, if I'm not mistaken, it might have been via pigs or chickens that were held in close quarters, and it spread to humans, which is just really out of something of science fiction, and then came from Hong Kong, obviously lots of connections to Toronto with the Chinese population here, and people were wearing masks here. And it was creepy as hell to take the subway. And some people were actually even taking time off work. Like, it was a big to-do, even though worldwide it was just a pittance of the amount of people who died in the Spanish flu. Mm-hmm. I think, not to minimize it, but it was probably 1,000 people worldwide. But again, when you don't have a cure, first responders, nurses were dying. Yep. And then you think, holy crap.
People are being quarantined.
Yes.
In their homes. In retrospect, I mean, I'm not going to say SARS was much ado about nothing. A dozen deaths is too many. I think about 12 people actually died from the disease. More people die every winter from the common everyday flu. But there was paranoia. I mean, I remember at the time I was living in the burbs and working downtown and taking the streetcar. And if one person would cough, everybody would kind of look around like, oh my God. If I coughed, I would be looked at. I remember the other thing that there were all these tips how to survive the SARS epidemic. Sanitize your hands. I remember going to Shoppers Drug Mart. This is our major drugstore, our Duane Reade. I guess in New York, they have Duane Reade.
Yeah.
Walgreens. And buying a big-ass jar of hand sanitizer, and the cashier looking at me as if I was infected. And it was kind of bizarre being on the subways and seeing all these people wearing these masks as if we are living in one of these contagion movies. It really was much to do with about nothing. But, okay, getting back to the crazies.
Well, yeah, you mentioned a streetcar because I was thinking whenever you have a movie like this, there's actually something called the trolley dilemma. And it's a philosophical, ethical dilemma where you have an out-of-control trolley that's about to kill 5 people. And you have a person who could deploy a lever, put the thing off its tracks so that it only kills 1 person. And do you do this? And it's purely utilitarian dilemma. Yes, you want to save the 5, but by your own doing, you kill the 1. So the army actually consults with the president about what to do, and they have a higher level communication. And if this is a contingency, if they cannot secure the perimeter of Evans City, or it looks like it's going to spread to the greater populace, they consider as an option taking this town out
right.
by nuclear means. And that should be exciting and fraught with peril in a way that, let's say, a nuclear meltdown movie like China Syndrome is. Whenever you have nukes, it should be exciting, but this is not particularly riveting somehow. Right. Even all these things are come together, I was not moved or frightened by it, and that's kind of a shame, mm-hmm. and it should not have happened.
So, yeah, this pathogen, the name is Project Trixie, which, interestingly enough, was the original title for this movie, before they changed it to The Crazies. It's in this town of Evans, and as I said before, people are being rounded up, and I guess the iconic image of this movie, the one you see in the posters, is the man in the white hazmat suit,
yes.
or as you call it, the
yeah.
NBC suit. I've never heard that terminology before, National Broadcasting Corporation.
Yeah,
and with the gas mask and the rifle or the flamethrower. And these are people that are, these are soldiers. And they're following orders. And in many ways, they're sort of fatigued, flummoxed, etc. They don't know what's going on. They don't know. There's not a lot of communication. Well, the communication with the higher-ups is really bizarre because they have this bizarre sort of way of securing the communication.
Yeah. Yeah, voice print, they called it. Yeah. I guess a voice recognition, a nascent technology. I'm not exactly mm-hmm. sure, but... And they kept having to, when they got disconnected, redoing it. And much to the consternation of scientists trying to find the cure. But they kept having to clear their voices to try and talk to the well, hires up.
Poor Dr. Watts was mm-hmm. one of the victims of this nascent technology, yeah. maybe being a little too nascent.
But yeah, ultimately what this is a failure of communication. Not at just a technical level, but at a... just a general level, because when you saw what happened with SARS, everyone knew what to do. They kept the populace abreast mm-hmm. of things, and you knew what your risk was. I think there was maybe a 30 to 40% mortality rate. You knew you had to wash your hands, cover your mouth, do all these kinds of things. These people in the town were told nothing.
The
word came out only because of the few that were inoculated who... Mm-hmm. who I guess, gossiped or what have you. They dropped the ball on that front. But they did not tell them, because far easier to get populace to be more compliant by actually telling them what's wrong. So they are fracturing into different groups. You have these Second Amendment types who are armed to the gills in their farmhouses fighting the army. And this is totally, like, the body count for the army was totally unnecessary if they had just told them what was happening.
Of course, because, I mean, that's where some of the fright comes in. Less the crazies, because the crazies aren't
crazy enough.
I was going to say, I mean, you know, there is a subtlety to this movie I can appreciate, because they're not raving lunatics, you know, foaming at the mouth, etc. But for those looking for pure horror, the crazies were not crazy enough. I mean, with the exception of the opening scene, you know, the father that ends up murdering the mother, burning his house down with the two kids in there. They do survive, but
they have to watch the horrific destruction of their homestead.
And they're injured and so on. There's nobody is actually like a raving lunatic. You do see a couple of, you know, all this weirdness is going on where they're trying to round up citizens, these Second Amendment types, and they're fighting back. You see these two women as if nothing is happening.
Yeah,
and they're sweeping the grass, you know, like with their... It's bizarre.
It's it was a great scene, yeah.
Yeah, but... I think that the fear is just this mass force of this army coming in with their identity totally obscured, so you don't know who they are, what they're doing. All they are is this one monolithic force coming in with this white suit mask, a weapon of destruction, be it a gun or a flint or whatever,
yeah.
wanting to round you up and take you into... take away your rights and corral you into a high school, and you're like, why? What's going on?
Yeah, maybe I'm going to contradict myself too, because I was thinking, let's say the communication was very clear. As we've seen from the anti-vaxxers movement, like, even if they said, like, you have to get together and we're eventually going to give you an antidote, a lot of people are so paranoid that they don't want anything to do with any government directive. So who knows, like, whether even they would have complied with such a request. So, but again, that was at a time when who knows what would have happened.
But
now we're more amenable to responding to these crises. Mm. Like, if SARS Redux came along, we would know what to do. And I think a strong argument, let's say, for universal healthcare, mm-hmm. which is vehemently opposed in the U.S. in some circles, would be an ability to coordinate and marshal your resources in the event of a crisis like this. Because Toronto hospitals really enforced like solid protocol. Like no one could visit their relatives for a long time. You had all this stuff in place when we dealt with SARS. So I thought, very interesting. So again, you have these splinter groups like trying to deal with this. And what would we do? Like, well, what would you do if someone ordered you to do something? Or, like, we're naturally independent people. We don't want to be told what to do. And if someone told us right now to go to the local whatever and hunker down in a local mall, like, would we even do that rather than just stay put here and defend ourselves here, especially without being told?
Well, unfortunately, we only have one little Mickey of Rye, so that's not going to last us too long. So.
Oh, my God, yeah, we would really need to hunker down and, and fortify ourselves with some more libations here, yeah.
But no, but that's a very interesting question. And the other thing, too, I mean, and that line from, I mean, I don't want to get too political in this because, you know, the world is, because the results of...
Very topsy-turvy.
Yeah, no one knows what's going to happen because of the election results in the States and stuff. And a lot of people that voted, I don't want to say it because I can't say it, but a lot of people that voted for this clown to become president, they did it because they had an inherent mistrust of the government, and they thought that he was, you know, this outsider, when really now he's populating his cabinet with a bunch of insiders.
Yeah, for sure.
But, I mean, you know, and one of the most prescient records ever is Pink Floyd, The Wall, right? Mm. And it deals with all these topics of fascism, the rights of individuals being trampled on by certain institutions and so on, whether it's your school, whether it's the government. And there's that line, and mother, can I trust the government? You know?
Yeah, yeah.
And that's the thing about the crazies, and that's what Romero was asking. Can we trust the government? They just led us into a losing war. You know, this is... I'm asking, what year precisely did the Vietnam War end? Do you know?
It would have been, I guess, early 70s, or when they de-escalated it would have been the late 60s, when in the heights of the protests, but they were still probably using, you know, napalm and whatever on Cambodia and whatever, but I think it really probably would have come to an end when this film was released.
So we can say
it was around the time. Well, he was filming it when it was in the heights of it. So
we could say this is somewhat like post Vietnam. Now, is this pre Watergate?
Oh, geez, I'm no good with years. I should know this because I've been to the Watergate Hotel in D.C. Oh, this is awful. I'm no good with years. I can't remember when Nixon was impeached.
But what I'm trying to say is the 70s was a time where there was a real inherent distrust of government, and Romero has always been a staunch left-wing, I don't want to say a liberal, just left-wing, as left-wing as they come. And
I think distrust of government crosses all political spectrum, sure. Like there's,
I mean, both the left-wing and the right-wing distrust the government, but for different reasons.
Yeah, exactly, yeah.
And Romero, he's very much left-wing, and his movies have explored these many, many times. There's always I'm not going to say always, because it wasn't in Martin, but in many of his most heralded movies, and especially the three, the major zombie films, your Night, your Dawn, your Day, there's always a government agency which is doing something or not doing something that's not benefiting the populace, you know? And you have these ragtag group of resistors, and this happens a lot in Romero's movies.
Yeah.
I mean, there's analogs in this movie and Dawn of the Dead.
Yeah, well, true. Well, we have authority figure police in the case of Dawn, and Green Beret in the case of this movie.
We're talking about the ragtag group of survivors.
And a nurse in the case of the crazies versus a paramedic in the case of Dawn of the Dead. So you have a faction. I mean, really, let's say we were in a group of 10 people, like, to whom would you defer? Like, you're a college professor, you know, would they listen to you? presumably you have more education than some of the others, but your ability to maybe teach people the fundamental rules of grammar does not necessarily lend itself to coping with a crisis. So you have, but then a cop who's like an authoritarian, but he's armed, so does he really know what to do other than just shooting people, really? Like, or you have a paramedic, should they lead people? Who knows who should lead anyone?
Or should even there be a leader?
But even with the authority figures here, there's a disconnect in terms of the communication between the commander-in-chief and these poor saps on the ground. So you have this character, Colonel Chris, who I call him Colonel Lando Calrissian, as he looks like him, kind of. And
I didn't see Enders.
Okay, yeah. That's okay.
He's
trying to implement these directives, but he's not getting the resources he needs to quarantine this town and prevent the spread. And there's poor put-upon Major Ryder, who's just constantly yelling for, he needs... I think there was canisters that they needed, self-contained canisters, so they could take blood samples from the people who are afflicted, send them to the main lab in probably wherever it would be, Washington, D.C., or whatever, Centers for Disease Control, try and find this stuff. They are not being given the adequate resources they need to succeed in their war, unquote, quote unquote. So that's another layer of things here, because, my God, you're just like, look at Iraq. It's like, give us more troops. We can't contain this. No, we're not giving you any more troops. Gee, I wonder what happened after that.
When Chris, and he's completely, you could tell just by his demeanor, he's fatigued, he's flummoxed, he's frustrated. And without spoiling too much at the end of this movie, it's like, it just continues. And he is told to then, I guess, it is spoiling a little bit, the perimeter has been broken, ostensibly, maybe has, and he's told to go somewhere else. And he's just like, fucking shit, here we go.
Yeah,
again.
Yeah.
And then is that Romero talking about war?
Yeah, it definitely is, because he's essentially being redeployed after having served his term. Or his
tour.
His tour, sorry, yeah. And so after risking his life at great personal expense to do this and mobilize and orchestrate this team, he's just... Oh, thanks for your service. By the way, you're going to be doing this all over again.
Exactly.
Rough
second
stuff.
Second verse, same as the first.
Yeah,
you know?
Exactly.
And it's like soldiers that would do their one tour in Afghanistan, come back, you're doing another one. Now you're off to Iraq. Mm-hmm. Now I was promised two tours, now it's four tours.
Yeah, it's brutal.
There are social issues that have not gone away.
Yeah.
In fact, with the way the political climate is now, I would love to see Romero, because he's a master of allegory, you know, with his... movies, especially the zombie ones. And we talk about the dead movies. It's hard not to call it a trilogy, because even though he made three other ones later on, they're lesser ones, right? But I think Romero can certainly, like, with what's going on now, and again, I don't want to get too political, because I'm
Well, who knows? Like, when you have an authoritarian figure in the White House now who is also protectionist, he's like a nationalist, I don't even know if he would fight anyone, because he's so America first, I don't want to, you know, I don't even want, I can't
well,
do my
it,
impression.
Is he, no, yeah, don't, please. Don't.
Yeah, I was going to try. All I can do so far is it's a disaster, and I'm not doing it justice. But yeah, who knows whether he would even engage himself foreign. You don't know with him. That's what makes it so frightening.
I've seen the movie for a while, but I mean, maybe the Dennis Hopper character in Land of the Dead had some similarities to the present life.
Yeah, maybe. Yeah, that was a terrible movie also. Yeah, and filmed in Toronto and just, oh, God. But yeah, let's call them the canonical three, because subsequent ones were shite. And we should also mention this was rebooted in 2010 in a very unconvincing manner. And instead of the hazmat suit being the iconic poster image, it became a pitchfork, which is really weird, because that was only the one of the, I guess, resistance fighters killed one of the soldiers with a pitchfork, but I don't know how that came to be so symbolic. Like, what is that? Is that a pitchfork as in, like, the townsfolk resisting with pitchforks and torches? Like, I didn't really get the symbolism of that, but it was kind of weak. There was a terrific, ironic scene where the hippie chick... what was her name again?
Kathy.
Yeah, she starts exhibiting symptoms of the affliction. She wanders out into the meadow, and she engages the soldiers in a really peacenik kind of maneuver, and I'm sure this was intentional. She was like a flower child. She introduces herself to them, saying, "Hi, my name is..."
Yeah.
"My name is..." whatever her name was.
Right.
"And
what's your name?
Yeah. And it was so innocent and peaceful, and then you have this...
and everything.
Guy, it was quite... lovely, and then you had this hilarious, the lambs running through the meadow, and the lamb obviously is a symbol of peace.
And docility and what have
you. And then they just blow her brains right out, and they don't even consider whether she might be healthy. They just, you know, guns a-blazing, shoot first, ask questions later, although they turned out to be right, but it speaks to the perils of an authoritarian regime running amok. So it was interesting, although they made the decision there, but ooh.
And perhaps in this heightened situation where everybody's emotions are on high, there's questions in some of these soldiers that they don't even know particularly what they're doing, nor they like what they're doing. They're just, quote-unquote, following orders. Maybe Romero was saying that any sort of...
unquestioned deference to authority.
Or any sort of magnanimous behavior means you're delirious. Because in this weird political climate, that's wrong. Everybody should just be shooting first and asking questions later.
True, but you know what kind of army would function if they didn't just defer to authority? That's the only way an army can survive and be an effective fighting force. But it's not just the army that has problems with authority, because the ragtag group of survivors is not exactly... behaving in the most forthright, honest of manner. Like, they are, especially the leader, David, who's the Green Beret, he is trigger-happy beyond belief, and he's warned by Clank.
Why aren't you singing this song like you did in our first book?
Fighting soldiers from the sky. Yeah, he takes out a bunch of these military guys who don't answer his question readily enough about what's going on. He blows their brains out, so it goes to show that on a micro level, authoritarianism rears its head in the form of David, who's the leader and just blowing people away, and then the authority figures are authoritarian. So it's a bleak Weltanschauung. Ooh, they get the German out. It's a bleak world view where you have a microcosm and a macrocosm of people deferring to authority, and that is what's scary. Actually, the more we talk about it,
I was going to say, maybe
this is a better movie than we're giving it credit.
I know, and I was going to say some more credits about this movie. It starts off in, is it fifth gear or first gear? I don't know anything about sports cars.
Oh, jeez. No, this is bad. Neither of us drives, even though we have licenses.
It starts off in top gear.
Yeah, top gear. There we go.
There's really no lull. It just starts off with the pedal to the metal. Mm-hmm. There's your metaphor, your driving metaphor.
Yeah.
And it goes. The other thing that's wonderful about this film is, in many ways, and this is very similar to Night of the Living Dead, it really... You know, one of the things that people really responded with that film is it felt real. It felt like it was happening. Documentary almost. Cinema verite.
Yeah.
This is, again, it feels almost cinema verite. That's what the 2010 remake didn't have. It had that glossy sheen, whereas this really felt gritty. This is happening. Nobody looked like an actor.
Yeah, I was going to say, to its credit, I mean, really, we don't want to be disparaging. No one looked like or... acted like an actor, because there's some spotty performances here, but they're working within their constraints, because they're one guy's supposed to be a volunteer firefighter, so you don't expect this guy to be Cary Grant. They're blue collar guys who maybe not the most loquacious types, so they play to their strengths, and Clank is that kind of figure, and he's the way he was written was kind of bad. He kept saying man after everything and dude, but he was sort of an everyman.
Yeah, but I mean, like, you know, Timothy Oliphant, who was in the Oliphant. What else has this guy been in?
Well, one of my favorite shows of all time, which is Deadwood, where he played the sheriff who comes into the town to try and establish law and order so they can do their gold mining or whatever it was, and then he's been in the awful, well, I liked it, but it's stupid, Turistas. He's the psycho killer in that, but he's above the material.
But he's a good-looking guy. He's,
he
you
really
know,
is.
Richard France, you know,
Dr. Watts.
And the figure of Dr. Watts is ironically wonderful. You know what, there is a lot to this movie that is good.
Well, that really affected me, actually, Dr. Watts's fate, and we won't get into it, but because he was on the cusp of finding the antidote and the cure, and then what happens to him is just, he becomes...
chilling and heartbreaking.
It is. Yeah. Like he's the victim of bureaucracy at the end of the day.
Not just bureaucracy, but also mass hysteria too.
Yeah, he could not escape his fate, and that was sad. Mm-hmm. So
this is very unique, because now it's like we're struggling now. Yeah. Here we are at the very outset of this discussion, saying we didn't really respond to this movie, and yet we're praising it in many ways. I think one of the reasons why it's hard to fully invest yourself in the Crazies, to fully love and worship the Crazies, is because, and this is my opinion, is the characters, we don't really know who, we do know who we're rooting for. We're rooting for the
quartet. The nurse and her beau.
Yeah.
But the rest of them, we're not, it's to a certain extent. Yeah. They're a little aloof.
They're like the farmhouse survivors in Living Dead, but they're not as well... rounded characters. I mean, okay, one is pregnant, i.e. we're supposed to sympathize with her. But other than that, we don't know much about Judy other than that she's pregnant, right? We don't know much about these two gentlemen except for the fact that they both were soldiers. One was a Green Beret, and they both at one point had designs on Judy. We don't learn as much as about them as we do, at, let's say, Flyboy, you know? Or Ken Forey's character, the name's escaping me right now.
Yeah, yeah.
In Dawn of the Dead. Or, fuck, even the character of Bub, the zombie in Dawn of the Dead. Of course,
much more compelling.
Had more humanity. Yeah. You know, so...
Yeah, and when Clank goes into the wilderness to as he realizes he's being afflicted, and he goes and sacrifices, he exhibits an incredible personal self-sacrifice for his friends, and then pays the price, you still are not feeling it. Somehow, you just feel an aloof disconnect from him in a way that you really shouldn't, because he's... He really is. He's selfless in his defense of his friends when we're really accustomed to people frothing at the mouth and attacking their friends. That's become a trope of this genre. So, yeah, but I felt a little bit distanced from these people, and I don't know if that was intentional or not. These are the every people we're supposed to be invested in, and somehow I just wasn't.
Nor was
I. I don't know why, but again, there's enough strengths. The strength to debit ratio is high enough that we can commend this.
Well, this is worth seeing. I mean, yeah. especially for American Police, yes, it's certainly worth seeing. Even Knight Riders, which is a movie that I found interminably boring. Some people do like it. I did not. You're American Policist, you got to see it.
Mm-hmm.
Even though it's not up there with, you know, your Martins and your Creepshows and your, you know, the
canonical, yeah.
The canonical. But anyway, what have you. But you know what? It's worth seeing. Do I want to say it's I'm not going to say it's a flawed masterpiece. I'm not calling it a masterpiece. It's a well-intentioned good movie with flaws. And at the same time, it fits canonically well in between Night and Dawn because a lot of the
characters, it seems like he was really trying to explore these themes that not to the fullest extent. I was also thinking, because another Toronto connection is how people respond to potential calamity, was the blackout. And I was thinking...
Same Summer of Sorrows. That was a crazy summer.
That was...
The whole eastern seaboard was affected.
The whole, yeah, all of, I think, from Philly on to the eastern, yeah, the bulk of the eastern seaboard had lost power sometimes 3 to 4 to 5 days. We lost it for several days, and I did not behave in a manner that was, you know, typical of someone who had their act together at the time. Well, given I was much younger, but I did not prepare for that whatsoever.
No one knew it was coming.
No, but when it happened, I blew all my money.
Mm-hmm.
Obviously, ATMs were not working, and which is like an electronically driven society comes to a halt when you have no electricity. I actually spent all night in a bar that night, and I blew all the cash in my wallet. And for people who weren't around at the time or live in other countries,
I spent about 3 hours in a bar drinking piss-warm beer, getting more and more progressively piss-warm because there's no cooling system.
There's no cool. Yeah, and we had ghetto blasters run with batteries, and we were listening to tunes, but I spent all my money in the bar with my roommates just drinking all night, and I had no provisions whatsoever, nor did I even think about that, because you just consider that, oh, we live in a modern industrialized world, and it's just a temporary thing. Modern. Now, it wasn't for a lot of people, and whether it be also the ice storm in Quebec, where people were out for 2 weeks with no power.
We had a power just a couple winters ago, where we had an ice storm that knocked out power.
Yeah, and it's like, it just shows how tenuously we're connected to one another, really, because all it takes is one thing to go out, and all the stores in Toronto, all the convenience stores were bare because everyone was buying out everything, and that's what I should have done had I had my wits about me. But of course, I wasn't. I was dropping $100 at the bar. Well, like, that was the sensible maneuver right there.
Oh
my god!
And the thing too is, I had no flashlights. I had no
candles. Me neither. I had one like little pocket flashlight with an inch diameter lens or whatever. It was pitiful.
This is sort of pre-cell phone. Now we all have our cell phones. Yeah. Like, hey, man, when the battery dies on this, what are we going to do? Right? Am I prepared now? After the lesson up?
No.
I still don't have a flashlight. But anyway.
And still no non-perishable foods. We learn nothing from that event.
Don't even get me started on non-perishable foods. I'm going to go off on a tangent right now, because why is it now that canned goods have expiry dates?
Ooh, yeah, I don't want to think about that. They're
called non-perishable because they don't perish. And yet now they're perishing. So I don't
know. Okay, as someone who eats as much canned tuna as I do, I probably have poisoned myself beyond repair to mercury. Okay. I don't even care at this point when it expires. I think the mercury coursing through my system is going to probably, getting back to dementia, probably give me premature dementia. But anyway, yeah, like we are not prepared. Nobody takes this seriously. Mm-hmm. What would we do in the event that our, well, it's hard to say in Toronto versus Evans City, which is actually where they film Night of the Living Dead. This is presumably a town that has 5,000 people.
Is Evans City a fictional city or an actual city?
It's an actual city, but they filmed Night of the Living Dead in the outskirts of the same city. But like Toronto, you're not going to quarantine us, but maybe you would have to, because 40 minutes east of here, driving, there's a nuclear power plant. This thing melts down. What in hell do we do? Because we saw what happened in Chernobyl. Anyone within a 10-minute radius of that was affected. And what would we do? Would we defer to authority figures? Probably not. Mm-hmm. If we were in New Orleans during Hurricane Katrina, we would be on the bar stool at the same bar in the French Quarter with all the people who decide to drink instead of going to higher ground. You don't know, because you don't take it seriously until it's a problem.
And nobody expects it to happen until it does happen. And then when it happens, I should have done this, I should have done that. Then when it's over, for next time I'm going to prepare by doing this, and then you don't
do it. Oh my God. I'm almost turning into a survivalist. I'm going to stock my pantry full of foodstuffs. This is making me paranoid.
But non-perishable goods are perishable now. But I think we've sort of veered on a bit of a tangent, but it's fun. But it's okay.
This is the stuff that is what makes biohazard movies so interesting, potentially. Our buddy Lewis, who is the producer, organizer of Horrorama, he tipped me off to Mulberry Street, which is a terrific Contagion zombie film, and that was so much more action-packed, and in many ways lots of these films are, but they don't touch on the symbolism and the allegories that Romero does here. And so there is a lot going on behind the scenes, as it were, with this film, but so you can overlook the fact that it's not the most compelling piece of work ever. But it has lots of ideas in it, so you should check it out.
What's interesting is that I feel like now that we've discussed the movie, I owe it to myself to give it a third viewing.
Oh my God, I think so as well. Yeah,
maybe we have to do a podcast, The Crazies Revisited.
I'm thinking that. Yeah.
Yeah. So, so interesting, because we started off saying that it didn't really measure up to
what we had in our minds.
But now we're talking about the movie, and there are a lot of credits to this movie. But I'll still stick with my star rating, my original star rating.
Yeah, our patent pending 0 to 5 star rating system, because it hasn't been patented. So it's what do we even give it?
Well, I'm just going to give it a 3 stars.
I think so as well. There's just enough going on that it may not scare you, but it gives you something to think about that could scare you, which I think it does stick with you weeks after, even if it doesn't viscerally get the adrenaline pumping. What did we learn?
I'm going to talk again about music. There's a refrain in the movie. At one point you just see the soldiers again. This is monolithic, terrifying.
Oh yes,
white clad. Yes, and I think you know what I'm talking about.
I do. Yeah. Well, there's lots of militaristic music throughout, and a lot of it has drumming and it's patriotic. I think one of them is a Civil War tune.
Well, when Johnny comes marching home.
Yeah. So it's all of this stuff is underpinning the militaristic motifs here, and that was
used incredibly. It was chilling when that song was written. It was pro military, but at the same time, I can't wait for them to come home. But here it was to sort of punctuate the fearsomeness of the occupation of these soldiers in this town. So I thought that was a wonderful subversion of that tune when Johnny comes marching.
Oh
home.
Yeah, well that's
it. That song has been used in that way a lot. In fact, I mean, The Clash have a song called English Civil War.
Oh, I thought you were going to say Civil War by Guns N' Roses.
No, well,
they much pretty, lower level, yeah.
Pretty much has the same, because I believe the song's in the public domain, so you can do whatever you want with it. Where they you know, again, it's an anti-war song, but they use some of the same lyrics, and they use the same melody. But yeah, it was a haunting refrain in this movie, and it was used really, really well. And yeah, kudos to Romero for that.
Well, interesting you used the phrase occupying force, because when the Saddam statue was toppled and the Americans took over, they actually hoisted stars and stripes. And when you talk about bad optics, that was not a good thing to do, because you had the populace on your side, but then you seem like an occupying force when you raise the red, white, and blue. It was a terrible move, and I think they couldn't overcome that at the time. So interesting, occupying force, like, yeah, who do you trust? All this kind of just paranoia ratcheted up. What I learned was also, you have another authority figure whose authority is completely undermined, and that's the father who's going to administer mass to the populace in this town.
Yes.
And the army comes in and runs over this guy and says, listen, we need to get the word out to your congregation, and we need to tell them something. And he tries to, like, this poor, you know, padre tries to ask, like, what the hell is going on, and they give him nothing. And this guy is just trying to figure out what calamity is befalling them, and he just gets shunted aside. Again, the failure, what we've got here is, again, failure to communicate. Cool Hand Luke, and they treat him like garbage, and they just storm in. And this is supposed to be churches are safe havens.
Right.
And he actually, because fire is a theme of this movie, he actually runs out of his church and immolates himself before being executed. It was an incredibly powerful scene.
And that harkens to that Vietnamese protester that did the exact same thing.
Oh, yeah.
In the Vietnam War, who immolated, was it a monk, who immolated himself in the streets to protest the war. So yeah, in many ways, this is that was a haunting scene, and yes, that.
But the haunting scenes were front end loaded in this film, and then it tended to, I guess, right at the beginning, and then it's sort of diminished in its impact toward the end. But still, yeah, as you said, in order to understand how he progressed as a filmmaker, you owe it to yourself to see it.
Therefore, I think we can commend it.
Well, a three is a mild commendation for sure.
Yeah, and you go in there with milder expectations than you would for, let's say, Dawn of the Dead. Or my favorite in the,
Canonical trilogy. Day,
I love Day. But, I mean, that's a movie that, the first time I saw it, I loathed it. And it took me probably about 6 viewings to really, really appreciate it. So maybe The Crazies is one of those. Maybe it's a grower, not a shower, you know?
Oh, boy. For more, definitely check out our website, www.reallyawfulmovies.com. Thrice weekly reviews of genre films of all stripes. You'll really dig it, we think. And for sure, check us out on Twitter, too, awful_movies, and send us an email. reallyawfulmovies@gmail.com. Let us know what your favorite contagion zombie biohazard outbreak movie is. We'd love to hear from you, and if you pass it along, we'll definitely podcast it. Anyway, we'll talk to you soon.
Take care. Thank you.